Cedric from New York City, so that is kind of a New York accent.
Do you have it open?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So what he's going to be talking about is this idea: if you have two ways something can happen, two possibilities, say for example the electron getting through to hitting one particular point, and there's no, we can't distinguish between the two, you have to add the amplitudes. So, oh, that's working. Great. So I will just enlarge that. So this is actually from, you can see, New Zealand. And this is the man himself. So really, and then looking at that, and what I went through, if there are two ways, and you can distinguish between them for an event to happen, to detect an electron, you add the probabilities. Okay, I will.
I'll try to make it not for
paper. That's good.
We've been talking about the, or what we're aiming to talk about, the theory that works the best, that we know the physicists like the best, that deals with a part of nature, and that's quantum electrodynamics, that deals with photons and electrons. Most of the time, we've been talking about photons. What we've discussed is that mainly the main idea we're talking about is some idea of the kind of framework of ideas which theoretical physics needs in order to describe the results of experiments. And I think by this time they'll agree, after two lectures, that they're very weird indeed and quite peculiar and difficult to believe. But I'll just remind you or review for one more time, a little bit, about what happens with photons. And as we said many times, two times before, we have a thought here, and the photon multiplier which makes count of photons, even if we have only one photon at a time, and if we have a more than one way that a thing can happen. And the example I can make several times is that the light couldn't, the photon we could imagine, would be reflected from two different surfaces. If there's more than one possible way that something can happen, the whole structure works. In any situation where you have experiments looking at something microscopic, which of course you have in the end to look at something macroscopic, that's large, and the photon multiplier amplifies up, when you have a system like that, you can't predict exactly what will happen, but only the chance that the system operates, that you find something happen here. And this probability is always given as a square, or the fractal to it, of a thing called an amplitude. And this amplitude is a kind of absolute square, a special kind of the square of the length. And the amplitude is nothing but an arrow drawn on a plane. Now when something can happen in more than one way, the amplitude that has happened, it's considered, calculated by adding the amplitude for it happening one way plus the amplitude that it happens the other way, and when you square that, you get the probability. In a problem like this, we have found that circumstances or the probability for this event might depend upon how far apart you put the plane. And you get reflections from a pair of plates which vary with the thickness in that manner. And so, this, in our particular example, I finally found out that was 16% and that was 8%. For each surface, there was 4%. Now, if this were a more ordinary thing, like you would expect, an ordinary type of reasoning instead of this esoteric, such microscopic thing, you would expect that the chance to arrive here could be analyzed by saying, of all the ones that come down, some bounce from here with a certain probability, and some bounce from here with a certain probability, let's say 1/5 bounce here, or one, what we say, 1/25. And 1/25 here would be 2/25 up there. would do would be to add the probability. We find out that instead of adding probabilities in such logical circumstances, we add amplitude. In other words, we can sit around and talk about it this way, say, there's a certain, can go either this way or it can go that way, and we just add the amplitude before we split. But that means that the logic that we can say that it really goes either this way or that way is false. You can't really say that in the common language way, or is it meant to add the probabilities? Because if you were to say it can either go this way, some of them come this way, and some of them come that way, you're at a total loss to understand why, when the thickness is just right, there is none of them come at all. Because if some of them come one way and some of them come the other way, the fact that they can go both ways surely isn't going to make it that they don't come at all. But that's exactly what does happen. And so the idea is to be able to say that it comes either one way or another. It requires that you know what you're talking about. You're not talking about ordinary, either one or the other, but either one or the other in the sense of adding amplitude. So if it's a crazy game, I still find myself saying, well, it comes either one way or the other. This is not really true that for a given particle which arrives here, you can say that it either came this way or that way. You get the sensible idea. As a matter of fact, it's entertaining. The following thing is very interesting. It is possible to put some kind of atoms on the surface here, such that when light bounces off it, they leave some trace that the atom is left in some other state than it was before. So that if it bounced the light from the surface, an atom on that surface would be left in a different state. Likewise, we can put atoms of this kind, it's rather technically difficult with light, you can do it in many, many analogous experiments in similar situations. But imagine if you do that this. And then we could say, let us bounce the light, and then afterwards, look at the atoms and see which ones are excited. What you discover is, if you have enough here, that you don't miss. If you forget the cases where you miss. And it's either excited here or it is excited there, yes. In other words, it does look like the photon either goes this way or that way. And when you have the atoms here, and you count just those cases in which you can find, see, I'm worried about the cases where you miss it. Forget the cases that you miss it. And take only the cases where either one or the other is atom is excited on one or the other sheet, and ask for the probability of arriving here. You know what you get as a result of this? As a function of thickness, a completely different result. If you have atoms there that can leave a trail as to whether light was there or not, you get 8% reflection no matter what thickness. In other words, it's tricky. You want to be clever. You know that if you have no way to tell from which one it comes. If the light after it bounces off is everything the way it was before, then you get this funny interference effect. If, however, you put something here to see if the light bounced here or here, you can tell it bounced one or the other. It tells you, it means the atom is excited. But lo, there's no more interference effect. Why? How do we describe that? It's not hard. It's that we change the problem. The first problem was, given a source here and material here. What is the probability that for the following event, that the photomultiplier goes off and that the system is left exactly as it was before, that nothing has changed in place? That's the first. But in the second experiment, we're asking for a different final problem. We're asking a different problem. The problem is, what is the chance, if we have a source here and this layer here, that the photomultiplier goes off and one of these atoms on this layer here, say, is excited? That's a different problem, has a different amplitude. And there's nothing to do with what happens down here. And that amplitude is 4%, or 0.2 rather, squared is 4%. Add some non-angle, I don't know the same thing. Squared 4%, and the probability that it's reflected from the front surface as detected by an atom is 4%. Likewise, if you ask for the following situation, that the photomultiplier should go up, and the bottom one should have an atom excited, you get it also 4%. So you see, if we try to test whether or not it's going one way or the other, then the results of the experiment have changed, or another way we have to ask about a different experiment. The case of interference is this, that if it's such a situation that the rest of the system, the glass, is exactly the same before and after, and there's no way to tell where the light bounced. Otherwise, if you have some way to tell, you'd ask for a different physical result,
have a different amplitude, and that's what it does. Which means this, these things I point out because as you've gone along, you've probably struggled to find some kind of a simple-minded explanation of these things. But when you see how annoyingly complicated it gets, I mean, not complicated, but curious it gets, it gets harder and harder to make a simple model.
Okay, finish there. It's kind of in
I also,
so that was Richard Feynman. I should mention he was one of the smartest physicists in the 20th century, won no Nobel Prize. Known as for being a master teacher as well, wrote a series of lectures, the Feynman lectures, if you've ever seen those, as red books. And also was just known for being a real character, very eccentric. He worked on the Manhattan Project, building the first atomic bomb in the Second World War, and as sort of a hobby to keep himself interested, he actually learned how to crack safes while he was working on the Manhattan Project, and actually used to regularly sort of break into the safes that they had that were holding like entire secrets and blueprints for the atomic bomb, and people didn't like that for some reason. But, so that is Richard Feynman.
He also
plays
drums.
Yeah, he played bongo drums as well, amongst many other things. And that wasn't a joke. Okay, so... Okay, so we looked at this idea, can we predict which slit each individual electron will go through, the double slit experiment? This one or this one? And so quantum physics says it's a genuine twin, it's a genuinely random event as opposed to a pseudo-random event. And you get this, this trait running all throughout quantum theory, this intrinsic randomness, if you like, as opposed to the pseudo-randomness of a roulette wheel. And it's not just here, but you get it, for example, in Schrodinger's cat. And just to... So an all familiar example, again, the smoke detector you might have at home, when your students might have at home, the radioactive decay in that. But Schrodinger's cat, actually, I should say, hands up who knows Schrodinger's cat. Okay, so about half to two-thirds. So this is a thought experiment. Erwin Schrödinger, 1935, from a paper that he wrote. And so I should emphasize, not something that we've done, but... and so I'll give you the both. There's a new updated politically correct version. So you have a box, and you have a cat.
Oh, your art class.
People laugh at Picasso and Van Gogh. It's an impressionistic cat. So, yeah, so cat, some... some radioactive substance there, and what it's set up is so that in 1 hour, that has a 50% chance of actually having a radioactive decay, and a 50% chance of not decaying. So it's 50-50 whether it will decay or not, and you have a Geiger counter. Here in the box, and if there's a radioactive decay event, Geiger counter will pick it up. And the Geiger counter is kind of linked up to a mechanism, so that if the Geiger counter goes off, then there's actually a, I think it was a jar of acid here, or cyanide. Cyanide, okay. There, and if it goes off, then it actually breaks and then releases, and then the original version kills the cat.
So the politically correct version is just some sleeping gas, so we don't kill cats. I think people thought the theoretical physicists went around killing cats. I'd just like to go on the record as dispelling that, saying I've never, ever killed a cat in an experiment.
In a box,
anyway. I'm a cat person. I love cats. So we have this here. And so, okay, so we know that we get this superposition in quantum mechanics, that things don't actually happen, that with the electron, the double slit experiment, it goes through one slit and it goes through the other slit. But until you actually make the measurement, everything's kind of in this fuzzy state, this superposition state, where you get both possibilities realized. And so the question is, what I should say is, okay, at the end of the hour, you actually open the box and you look at, or actually at the end of the hour, you open the box to see where the cat is alive or dead. So obviously, half the time you do that, you see the cat is being dead, and the other half you see it as being alive. And the question is, just before you've opened the box, you have not looked in, is the cat dead or alive? So that's the million-dollar question. And so what quantum physics says is that this could be as microscopic as you like. It could be just a single atom that has 50% chance of decaying. And that quantum physics says that it doesn't actually decay or not decay, but what it does, it goes into a superposition state. So again, the idea of superposition is crucial, of decaying and at the same time not decaying. So if we were to write it, we'd have sort of decaying plus not decaying. So it's kind of a superposition here. But if this is in a superposition state, it hasn't decayed or not decayed, then there's this chain or sequence of events. It's linked up with a Geiger counter. And so that means the Geiger counter will not have decayed or will not have detected or not detected. But if the Geiger counter is in this limbo state or the superposition state too, then it's hooked up to the acid or the cyanide. So the cyanide will actually be either in a superposition of being not decayed or decayed, obviously the cat will then get in some sense infected with this superposition. And either be in a superposition of either having died and having not died. And so at face value, a natural way of looking at quantum mechanics is to say that the split second before you've actually opened the box, the cat is both in this somehow gray limbo state of both being dead and alive. It's in a superposition state. So the mathematics of superposition. So the mathematics of the electron going through two slits at the same time essentially is the same mathematics of the cat and Schrodinger's cat. You have two possibilities, but instead of them being a single electron going through one slit or the other slit, it's just scaled up massively. And you have a cat either being alive or dead. And so it's another example of superposition. What is actually going on, what really means, is again something Hans Westman will talk about on Friday. But of course, when you actually open it, you never see cats that are both dead or alive. So again, this idea that you collapse the wave function, you actually collapse the state. So you see the cat 50% of the time being dead or 50% alive. So again, if you've got 100 cats, hypothetically, and we did that, we'd see 50 of them dead and 50 alive, roughly speaking. Yes?
What was the context when Hawking said, what I hear about Schrodinger's cat, I reach for my gut?
Oh, right. I think that was just, I've heard, I'm not sure if this is true, but I heard he has some sympathies for the many worlds point of view. And so he would have a different view of this. And that really, you talk about the world splitting into two, and you have a different take on Schrodinger's cat to what I've just talked about. And you have two Schrodinger's cats, one's dead, one's alive.
Where would I find that? And be able to look it up in more detail.
I'm not sure. I'd have to think about that for a while. But I'm not sure. I'm not sure where the point comes from. Probably a top of your eye.
Because the next time I talk about Schrodinger's cat in my class, I'd like to mention
Hawking's. I mean, I know where I got the quote. I can tell you the book where I got the quote from. But it's just a quote. I'm happy to talk to you about it later. Yes?
What I don't understand is why is the Geiger counter detecting the particle? Why does that collapse the wave function and therefore stop all the quantum mechanics funny stuff?
Observation.
It says interferiously, so the Geiger counter has detected that particle.
You can't tell that it's technically
looking.
Yeah.
But you're talking consciousness matters here?
Yeah. Well, I mean, this gets very fuzzy. So So the thing is, there are different ways of looking at it, but it depends on actually what you count as detection, what you mean. Because standard postulate is that when you make a measurement, you collapse a wave function. I mean, that's what Bohr said. But the thing is, and again, Hans will talk about this on Friday, what is your precise, this is science, you should have a precise, well-defined definition of what actually constitutes a measurement. And we do not have one. And you could do exactly the same thing, but you could change the Geiger counter. You say, well, the Geiger counter is a measuring device. You could rub that out, and you could change it to not being a measuring, not being something which we obviously recognize as being a measuring device. But just anything, something else, any kind of physical system that somehow links up to this. So,
but if the system can tell if it's a particle or not, it's making an observation, and it's not making an observation,
well,
interfering with that thing.
Well, I mean, do you have a precise... It depends on what you mean by making an observation. I mean, there's an ambiguity there. I mean, what counts as an observation and what doesn't?
The cat, when it does.
Yeah.
But you can't...
So definitely, I mean, quantum physics, unless you have this extra rule, this collapse, it doesn't precisely tell you exactly where the collapse occurs. And so there are different ways of looking at it, but this is Schrodinger's analysis of it. I might take one more question, and I want to get into Heisenberg.
I think clarify that a little bit. Is that all? Like, a lot of it is all based on probabilities,
right?
And once you, probabilities are really based on your ignorance, right? If you flip a coin and you don't look at what it is,
yeah,
it's kind of like that. It's
right.
Heads and tails at the same time. Like, that's what they're saying, pretty much the same idea as that. But as soon as you look at it and you see its heads, the chances of it being tails just went down to zero.
Right.
So it's just by doing an observation, you change the probability of something happening. Like, if you're flipping a coin 50 times, and you look at the first one and it's a heads, the chances of getting 50 tails just went down to zero. But there's still a chance you get 49 tails.
Yeah.
But the most likely chance is that you get somewhere in the middle, so it makes the kind of...
Yeah, so that's the probabilistic way, yeah. Okay, might move on now. And I'll just mention that it's not completely random that if we do this experiment many times, we can actually get the statistics. And the statistics, the probabilities is given by psi, the wave function, or the square of the modulus of that. And we can actually calculate very precisely. We can't calculate where an individual electron in the delta slip will land, but if we have a large number of them, we have very precise probability rules. So we can make a very accurate prediction for ensembles or on average. In terms of practical applications, you'll actually see this at the Institute for Quantum Computing. And they actually have, you can buy commercially available genuine random number generators as opposed to pseudo-random number generators. And this company, ID Quantique, if you're looking to get a Christmas present for someone that has everything, that's the website there, that's a picture of them. I don't get a commission or anything like that. So, and if you look at the advertising slogans they have on their website, it's when random numbers cannot be left to chance. And I like the fact that the uses include gambling and lotteries. So it's good to see that quantum physics and all the minds are actually being put to very, very useful, productive use in society. And this leads on to something called quantum cryptography or secret codes based on quantum physics. And you actually see those at the Institute for Quantum Computing this afternoon. But really, it's using this genuine randomness to get genuine, if you really want genuine random numbers. And this raises deep philosophical questions. And that is fundamentally the world one big casino? And it's very hard, I think, for students or people to get around their head if something just happened. So you're telling me I have a single americium atom in my smoke detector here, and you know, something you can buy. It just happens to decay or not. There's no hidden cause that we don't know about. And is that really possible? Sort of metaphysically or philosophically. Should we just accept quantum mechanics tells us that this is what we should say, or should we take some other stance? So what we might do now is I'd like to use to ponder that issue and to actually think about that. And this uses a teaching technique that I found out about at a recent physics teachers conference I went to in the US. And what I'll do is actually maybe we'll go through the technique and then I'll explain about it. So I was giving this talk, so I'm kind of making the story up, but this is, you get the idea, this is how the technique works. So I was giving this talk to some people yesterday, and they actually found this kind of issue interesting. Can things really just happen, just occur? And so I was talking to David, and David said, well, I don't think that's the case. And so David said, well, physics must be deterministic and causes and chains of events, as it's impossible for something just to happen for no reason whatsoever, and just to spontaneously occur. There must be some deeper hidden cause underlying why each electron goes through the slit that it does. And we just haven't uncovered it yet. There must be something below quantum mechanics. And Andrea was also there, and she said, well, we must take quantum theory at face value. So if quantum theory tells us it's a random event, we have to believe in it, because it's been proven by experiment after experiment. You've got to trust your science. It's what it says. So each electron, we should accept that it fundamentally goes to the slit in a random way. And also Joanne was there. And Joanne said, well, physics is just a collection of artificial models, a set of convenient fictions that we use. And you don't want to take them too seriously. They're not, physics is not reality. They're just the models of the theories we have. So we can never tell us whether the world out there is really, really random. Only philosophy or religion, you know, something deeper, more fundamental, can tell us, can answer such a question. So what I'd like you now is to split up into, or divide yourself up into groups of three, talk to the people around you, and then I'll give you 3 minutes to think of whether you most associate which of those you believe is right. So I'll say now, there is no right or wrong answer. This is a very metaphysical question, but if you could think of which student you think is most correct there, which person is most correct, and most associate, which do you believe? So, and then actually write that person down on your whiteboard, and then we'll actually get a show of hands. So, 3 minutes. But thank you, boss. It's perfectly been a great discussion. It's been fun. Okay. So for everyone, you're gonna have your attention. Okay, everyone, put their whiteboards up. Show your answer. Okay, David, Kate, Dave, all, A. What is that? A for Andrea. Okay, so this is good. So I just get a snapshot of what's going on in your mind. So there are a lot of Davids there. There are some people who are all, a few Andreas, I think one or two Joanne. So that's good. It's good that we have a diversity of opinions. And so what I actually would like to do now, so I'll give you 2 minutes to do this. What I'd like you to do is find someone, a group of people that had a different answer to you, and then discuss and debate and try and convince that other person to change their answer.
You're wrong!
Okay. There's no right or wrong answer. If you have any questions, I direct you to Hans Westman on Friday. If you haven't talked to him, he will be touching on this. And why I bring this up, this is an example of a teaching technique. As I said, I got it from a teaching conference in the US. And it's really a good way, if you have, for really bringing out student opinion. So essentially, just make up these fake people, and you have as many of them as you like. And if you know on a particular topic that your students, through past experience, have some sort of misconception or a wrong idea about some particular physics, and it doesn't have to be on modern physics, and you really want to bring that out in the open, get the whole class thinking about it, to put it out on paper, and then have them discussing it and seeing what the implications of it are, you could try and, you know, get your students trying to elicit it from your students, get them to tell you what their misconceptions are or their wrong ideas. But that could be very hard because people could be shy about telling the whole group, or they might not be able to, if they're not shy, they might not be able to kind of, express it as succinctly and as clearly as you could. So you make up these fake people and then you give them. So you might know that a lot of your students are thinking this because you are, for whatever reason, you're at a religious school or they all take philosophy class. So, you know, a lot might be thinking this is a good way of very quickly bringing this opinion out in the open to actually get them discussing the merits and the drawbacks of it. And another one example where you could use that, a strong student misconception is Newton's first law, that if you have somebody and it's moving, or some object that's moving along at a constant speed, the natural state of rest of an object, or the natural state of an object is rest. So there's no net force acting on it, it will just naturally go to rest. So you could have two fake people, you could look at that and actually say, one person could say, according to Newton's first law, if you get some object, a car or something that's moving along a frictionless road at a constant velocity, it will still continue to do that forever because there's no net force acting on it. You could summarize that in the student opinion. And you could have another one saying, no, the natural state of an object is at rest. It will just, for natural, some fundamental reason, just slow down and come to a stop, to put it there. And you could come up with some third opinion and actually bring these out and get students to discuss and debate those. This is a very useful technique. So that's one teaching approach. So, okay. Moving on. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, the last core concept. So in Newtonian physics, we can measure both the position and the velocity of any object precisely. So we have a speck of dust that's drifting across the room. We can know exactly where it is and exactly how fast it's moving, in principle, down to the gazillionth decimal place. No fundamental restriction on our knowledge. So this is not true for quantum entities like electrons. And it seems as if hardwired into nature, there's the limit, there's this constraint on just how much we could know about the world. Yes?
If our dynamics curve is made up of electrons and each has the probability, then can we actually measure the dynamics curve precisely to the gazillionth decimal place?
So no. So what you can do is probably the center of mass. The center of mass of the speck of dust. You could measure the center of mass motion, the center of mass velocity to increasingly greater and greater degrees. So there's no fundamental restriction on those. But if you actually, ultimately, yeah, every macroscopic object is made up of a speck of dust. It's made up of atoms and electrons and so forth. So if you think, well, okay, can we measure? So there are the fundamental restrictions on those. So absolutely. So you cannot measure. If you want to look at it at a microscopic point of view, then you can't. But if you have a Newtonian speck of dust in the Newtonian world, then you can actually, there are no fundamental restrictions on that. So to do this, let's think about how Heisenberg's uncertainty principle plays out. And let's think about this through a fictional story about Werner Heisenberg, the man himself, and how he actually came to come up with his uncertainty principle by trying to use a microscope, so an idealized microscope. So it's a game of thought experiment. And this goes back, I think it was 1927, the original paper, and that's a gamma ray microscope. So it's looking at gamma rays, very, very high frequency, very short wavelength, to try and actually measure, find out where an electron is. And this is a very rough schematic diagram. And so one day Heisenberg walked into his lab and set up his idealized thought microscope. Gamma ray microscope. But there was an electron. He wants to find out where it is how fast it's moving, position and momentum. And then there's the objective lens of the microscope, the eyepiece, and also there's the eye for actually measuring, detecting. And we have light coming in from the left here, so the x-axis here is parallel to the x-axis. So we have some plane wave of light that's incident on of one particular frequency and incident on the electron. And so Heisenberg realized that to see an electron, what you've got to do is you've got to interact with it. To see anything, to make a measurement of it, you've got to have some interaction between the thing you're trying to measure and the actual light. So this is what he did. And as Heisenberg was intimately familiar with Einstein's photon hypothesis of light, what he realized is you can think of the light, instead of being made up of the waves or the wavefronts for the light there, we can think of being made up as kind of a shower of reflection of particles all streaming in from the left, and a large collection of these objects. And so, as he made sure the light was traveling parallel to the x-axis, he knew that we could think of the momentum of each photon. They all have the same frequency, the same wavelength, the momentum px that is all in the x direction, as being h, where h is Planck's constant, given by that expression there, divided by lambda, the wavelength. And lambda is the photon's wavelength. Of course, because he was good friends with Compton from the Compton effect, as you know, we could think of these photons collide with the electrons, or with the electron, in particle-particle collisions that are modeled by the Compton effect. And so while Heisenberg was fine-tuning his microscope, he suddenly thought, at least one photon must collide with the electron and then recoil off into the microscope for me to know or have any idea for the microscope to be any of use. Because if zero photons go in, you're not seeing anything that's come from the electron, so you can't get any information. So he began to think in more detail and visualize in his lab how the collision process would actually work, what's actually happening. And so we have this electron here, and this could have an initial momentum of its own, and at some particular position. And the photon's coming in there, and this is before the collision. And afterwards, what we have is the electron scattered off in some particular direction. And the photon will be scattered off, and so what the photon likes, some of the photons, they'll be scattered off, they go into the objective lens, and then they'll go on to the eyepiece. So this is essentially what happens. So Heisenberg realized, as he was actually going through looking at the eyepiece and thinking through what would happen, is that actually each photon, that the photons could come in at different parts of the objective lens. They wouldn't necessarily all go in at the middle here, or at the left edge, or at the right edge. There'll be some distribution where the photons hit the objective lens. And that's fundamentally because if you get 1,000 photons hitting the electron, and you repeat that 1,000 times, there's actually which directions the photons scatter off is a random event. There's actually some probability distribution for the electron, for the photons scattering off in this direction, that direction, any other direction. So it's a game, it's a random probabilistic thing that we find all throughout quantum physics. It's not, they always scatter off in one direction. And so this is what we find, but the point is that no matter whether the photon reaches the very edge of the objective lens, or this edge here, they all end up going onto the eyepiece and seeing them with your eye. And so when you actually see one photon in your eye, you have no information, you have no idea whether it was a photon that hit that edge of the objective lens and came up and went into your eye, or hit the other end. So it doesn't tell you, it doesn't have a little label on it saying, yes, I was kind of reflected off or actually transmitted through this edge or that edge. You have no idea. So you have this uncertainty about where the photon actually came into the objective lens, which edge. And so let's assume we have a very, very wide objective lens. Then the two extremes are a photon going in this across here and a photon going in here, and there's uncertainty. We cannot distinguish between those two events just from the information that we know. as far as we know, looking at the other end of the microscope into the eyepiece, that for each photon we see, it could have been scattered off in this direction, or it could have been scattered off in the other direction. So if we look at how the extreme possibility, so this possibility corresponds to just a glancing blow, that we have the electron here, and the photon's coming in here, and it just glances off. There's very little momentum transfer from the photon to the electron, and goes into this very wide objective lens here. And in that case, if we're looking at the momentum of the electron in the final, in the x direction, that means that corresponds to this case here. The photon, very little difference in the between the final momentum and the initial momentum of the photon in a very, assume it's a very, very wide lens. So really, this is going like way off to here. So the scattering angle is zero or very, very small. In that case, the final momentum of the photon will be approximately equal to the initial momentum. So by momentum conservation, there's no momentum transfer to the electron. So that the initial final electron momentum is the same as the initial one. So that's that case there. But in this case, this is like a head-on collision, that the electron goes in here, collides, and then bounces right back. And in that case, assuming the frequency of the photon stays the same, it has so that's initial that's final there. Initially plus h divided by lambda momentum in the x direction. Finally minus. And so what's the difference between the two, those two? It's 2 h bar divided by lambda. So that is how much momentum transfer we give to the electron, how much momentum is transferred in the x direction. Whoops. So that's that case. So these are the two extreme possibilities for the final momentum of the electron, either the initial plus 2h bar divided by zero, or just the initial momentum. But we can't distinguish between those two. We can't tell just from the final information looking through the eyepiece. Again, the photon doesn't say, I was a photon that went through this extreme edge of the objective microscope or the objective lens because I was just came from a glancing collision. Or it doesn't say, there's no way for us to gain information, yes, it was a head-on collision and it came back and it went through, that a photon that goes through this process and a photon that goes through that process, they look exactly the same to us when we look at them through the eyepiece of the microscope. So we have this uncertainty as to whether this happened or that happened or any of the events in between. So a collision like that. So if we have some uncertainty about the photon's momentum, we have some uncertainty about how much momentum it transferred to the electron. And where the uncertainty of the two possibilities is, the uncertainty of the momentum is the difference between these two extreme values, but really we would just want to divide that by two, because that gives us the total distribution, and you just want to find half of that to find the uncertainty, because it gives you the total spread. It's really like if you have a bell-shaped curve, the uncertainty of the standard deviation is sort of a measure of from the middle out to one standard deviation there, the middle out to some sort of value where it drops off by some sufficient amount, right about two-thirds. So here we have the difference between the two extreme possibilities and dividing by two, and that's just the twos cancel out, that just gives us h divided by lambda. So that gives us a measure of our lack of information about what the final momentum of the electron is in the x direction. So basically, because the microscope doesn't tell us what the final momentum is of the photon, that necessarily leads us to have some uncertainty, some lack of knowledge about what the final momentum of the electron is. So we don't know how much momentum the photon transferred to the electron. So uncertainty momentum of photon leads to electron uncertainty. So this is where we get the value for delta px, uncertainty of advancement of photon in the x direction. And so as Heisenberg was thinking all these things were going through his mind, he actually thought that, well, he was looking out a window at the university campus and watched students scurrying around, going to the lectures and bumping into each other. He reflected on the fact that at the quantum level, really a measurement process is a very violent event. That if you're trying to measure an individual quantum particle, the measuring device that you're going to use is going to be at least as big as that, because you can't get anything smaller than an individual quantum particle. And so at the quantum level, measurement is a very violent event. You bang this electron into, bang this photon into an electron, and it collides off, and the electron is sort of jarred off in a different direction. And so you really necessarily disrupt and disturb in a very, very significant way by any measurement of an individual quantum energy. It's a fundamental thing. And so he thought, well, I really want to just decrease the uncertainty. I want to, as accurately as possible, know the momentum of the electron. And so Heisenberg thought there are two ways to do this. What he could do is actually decrease the intensity of the incident light so that just one photon hits the electron. So actually just make it the minimum amount, sort of millions and millions of photons, just one single photon. And also he thought, well, maybe we could decrease the kind of kick or the impulse or push that the photon gives the each electron. And the way we could do that is by decreasing the frequency of the photon, or increasing its wavelength. Because as we increase the wavelength, the momentum of the photon decreases by p equals h divided by lambda. But turns out if you actually do that, so one photon, increasing the wavelength actually has flow-on effects that we'll see. And as you, so you want to decrease the wave or increase the wavelength of the photon, and as you increase the wavelength of the photon, that will give you a smaller and smaller and smaller uncertainty of the momentum. But it turns out that necessarily a bigger wavelength actually increases the uncertainty of the position measurement. So you have this trade-off. So you make one thing better, the uncertainty in the momentum measurement, you make the other thing worse, uncertainty in the position measurement. So from its height, let's look at what you actually see when you look through the eyepiece of the microscope, assuming it's a circular aperture, circular microscope opening. So I have a view from his undergraduate days, as far as we know, electrons are point particles. They don't seem to have any size as far as we approach them. But he also recalled from Optics 101 that we do not see them or any other object as a point-like dot in a microscope. That due to diffraction, we actually see them as spread out. They have some finite region. And so assuming we have a large number of electrons incident, a large number of photons incident on the electron hitting it, and we, for the moment, ignore the collisions, what we would see is the electron not as a sort of a point-like dot, but this kind of smeared-out disk, or actually series of rings, and an airy disk, or the airy rings, that you actually see. Basically because the light gets through the circular aperture, the objective lens, and then light, what does light do? It diffracts after it gets through a slit or some sort of opening, and actually spreads out. So it spreads out in this sort of circular pattern, and it gives you a disk. And so the, given certain assumptions, the size or width of that is roughly of the order of the wavelength. So if you actually increase the wavelength, you actually increase the size of the airy disk here. And the electron's located at its center. So even though you get this representation of the electron at right in the middle of it with lots and lots of photons here, you actually find out you can know where the electron is with some precision. But the point is, how you actually, this is a pattern that you actually build up by millions and millions and large numbers of photons. So actually build up the pattern with the airy disk is that one photon hitting there, another one there, another one there, another one there. So lots and lots of photons. And just as the you build up the whole pattern, the overall interference pattern, with the in the double slit experiment, you saw the kind of the interference pattern. What you build up that is by photon, and you can predict the overall pattern, what the shape of that will be. Each individual electron still hits at a random place within that pattern. You cannot predict where each individual electron will be detected in the double slit experiment. And so just as that's the case, so you get the same thing here, that if you actually build up this pattern photon by photon at a random location, each photon hits. And so what that means, if you get, looking at your eyepiece here, this is a... The eyepiece, you actually have just a single photon going into your microscope and going into the eyepiece, and you find it here. That doesn't mean that necessarily that the electron is actually at that position or the position corresponding to that. All you know is that it's somewhere within the airy disk. That's one point of it. And if you, it could actually be that if you continue the experiment, that actually would be at the center of the airy disk, and you build up this pattern photon by photon by photon. But also it could have been a point just on the edge of the disk, that if you had one photon being detected there, that that could have been right at the edge here, so that the position of the electron was there. There's no one-to-one correspondence between where, bam, one photon hits and where the electron hits. There's some maximum margin of error, and that is roughly a wavelength, because you know the size of the disk is not more than a wavelength. So this dot here is pretty much not going to be any more than a wavelength away from the position of the electron. And so that gives you margin of error. That gives you the uncertainty of where you know the electron is. So that gives you uncertainty delta x equals lambda, the wavelength there. So if we put those two together, we have the delta uncertainty, what we know the position of the momentum of the electron is, of h bar divided by lambda. And we know that the uncertainty of the position is lambda. Multiply those two together, and then we find out we get delta, the lambdas cancel out, and we get delta x multiplied by delta b equals lambda. And what we tried to do, so Heisenberg, so he tried to optimize the microscope, so get as accurate a measurement as we could. So that means why we have the inequality there is we could have been a lot slacker, we could not try to optimize the measurement at all. And we can always get a greater value for the uncertainty. It's very easy to get less information than you possibly could. So that's why we have the inequality there. And so then Heisenberg, given that he discovered it, this came to be known as Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. And Heisenberg also went on to do a more detailed argument, more precise, those sort of higher mathematics. You can actually find out that you find something up until, you know, a couple of constant factors. Really, it's 4 pi, which not very much at all compared to the Planck constant, which is 6.63 by 10 to the minus 34. So h bar is just h divided by 2 pi. So you get something more precise argument, very, very similar, but just a different factor there, a couple of pi's and a couple of 2's there. So what this is saying is that there's this hardwired fundamental limit in nature that you cannot measure both position and momentum of a particle and electron to arbitrary accuracy. And that it's not something to do with the fact that Heisenberg was just bad as an experimentalist, and that where experimentalists are lazy, they need to work harder, that they have more precise experiments, if they are more careful, that they can actually beat this principle. It seems as Mother Nature actually fundamentally at the bedrock has that principle in. And it's nothing to do with the imperfect equipment. If you have a Nobel Prize when doing it, the best equipment in the world, there's no way to fundamentally beat this limit. And so that's why when professional physicists sometimes in their inboxes, they get various people emailing them at random saying, I have come up with a scheme where I've beaten Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. I can measure X and P absolute to with arbitrary accuracy. I can beat the uncertainty principle. So the uncertainty principle pretty much just follows from the basic postulates of quantum mechanics. And so when physicists get emails like that from cranks in their email inbox, they just press the delete button. They don't even read them because there's no point in looking at them. And this is actually a defining trait of quantum theory. And so in some sense, it seems as if the world is just kind of geared up that it's kind of, in a sense, you may think of it as being a bit cruel or a bit mean, that It doesn't allow you to get this information. You think you ought to be able to both the position and the momentum of an electron. And philosophically, maybe it's that these properties do not simultaneously exist. Maybe not just that we cannot measure them. You could imagine an electron could have a position and it has a momentum, it just we can't measure it. One way of interpreting it is that not only we could not measure it, but they simultaneously do not even have a definite position and a definite velocity at the same time. And so I'll just mention, as it's an inequality, there's no reason why the product of delta x and delta p in some experiment could not be as large as we like. You could, but the thing is, if you try it as best you can, the very idealized you can do is getting them down to h bar divided by 2. And there are many, many states that actually have, it's very easy to get that larger than that value. Yes, question.
So it's fair to say that the uncertainty principle, it exists because it assumes you're using light as a measuring tool. But theoretically, why
right.
can't the electron have a definite position and moment, theoretically? Before
right,
you,
right.
Before you even
yeah.
measuring it, why is that?
So if you think of it, one way, if you think of the electron as being represented by this probability wave or probability amplitude wave, this this wave function, and you write them down, they're always kind of, they always have some spread in space. So they're kind of smeared out, if you like, in space. And it turns out if you actually, so for every, actually I'll get some chalk. So if we have some electron represented by this kind of wave and or a wave function, I'll use the symbol psi here, and that will have some spread delta x there. So it turns out that, so that's one electron. It's one electron. So it turns out for, if you actually look at that and mathematically try and figure out what the momentum distribution of that is. So from this wave function, that contains all the information that, about an electron. So if you, you can actually find out from that, you can actually calculate what the momentum spread of that is, what range or spread of momentum values you would measure if you actually measure to see what the momentum is. It turns out that there's an inverse relationship. So by going through a bit of mathematics, it's actually Fourier analysis or a Fourier transformation, you can find out that turns out that the narrower this is, the narrower you actually have this delta x of your wave function, and then you go through the mathematics and do this Fourier analysis. Really, if Fourier transform this, then it turns out the wider necessarily this distribution is. And for a, if this is very wide, the delta x, then you can have a very narrow distribution of momenta. So,
is it theoretically possible to slow down an electron to like?
Yeah. So you cool it down. You have to get it to absolute zero, but you could slow it down to very, very slow speeds. One way of thinking about this, if you have a plane wave, so a plane wave, what a plane wave is, that's spread out everywhere in space, so it has infinite extension. So a plane wave is like a wave function which has a delta x of infinity. It's spread out everywhere in space. But does a plane wave have a well-defined precise momentum? Yes, it does. It has a wave vector k, it has exact momentum. So in that case, you have, that's a particular example of delta x equals infinity and delta p equals zero. So that's one particular case there. And another way of thinking about it, if you have Yeah, so that's one example. Hopefully it makes some sense. So, yes, Michael.
So that means if you cool the electron down to absolute zero, it would appear entirely as a plane wave.
It
wouldn't be located in a microscope at all at absolute zero. It would be spread out over an infinite.
Well, I mean, it's always hard because temperature is a macroscopic aggregate thing. So it's hard to talk about the temperature of an individual electron. It would depend on the details of the experiment, but I'm not sure if it's as simple as that. Okay. What I might do is, just to keep on track, is I've just got one or two things to finish because we're almost at the end of the core concepts of quantum theory. So what I just want to finish off one or two more slides so you know everything about quantum theory. And then you can go and you can give them lectures at the Institute for Quantum Computing this afternoon. That might be a good exercise. So I just want to make sure, because I'll be ringing me up in a minute and asking me, well, do they know everything about quantum mechanics? So I really want to make sure I can say yes. So you'll see at the Institute for Quantum Computing, one example, an application is quantum cryptography, quantum secret code. And so you'll actually see that, but this actually uses Heisenberg's uncertainty principle in a kind of a roundabout way. But if I say want to send a secret message to Ed way at the back of the room there, I could somehow encode that secret message in, somehow kind of hide it in both the position and the momentum of a particle. So what I could do if I want to send the letter A, I could give the electron some particular momentum, one value. If I want to send the letter B, I could give it another value, and C another value. So I could have some sort of link between the momentum of, I could make it some alphabet. So by Ed measuring the momentum of the electron, he could find out what message I'm trying to send. You could just, the simplest code would, oh, so, would be just something like a momentum of 1 kilogram meter per second is A, 2 kilogram meters per second is B, and so forth. And I could send the electron or a whole bunch of electrons to Ed and send him a secret message. And at the same time, as well as encoding information in momentum, I could also encode information in position. And I could have a, by using some sort of a code like that. And so the point is, if you don't know, I could actually switch between the two. So sometimes encode information in position, sometimes encode information in momentum. So the details are kind of complicated. Well, they're not that complicated, but they take a little while to explain. But the point is, you can encode information in the position and momentum, and you can send a secret message. And the point of, kind of, it's like Heisenberg's uncertainty principle protects it. Because imagine you're an eavesdropper. So to get for the particles, the electrons, to get to Ed, they've got to pass through everyone else in this room. And one of you could be a little spy or an eavesdropper or a snooper trying to look at it. But necessarily, if you make a measurement of the momentum or of the electron, what you do is you necessarily disrupt it or you disturb it, just as we saw that to actually measure the momentum and the position of the electron, the photon has to scatter off it, so it collides with it. And that's actually a very noticeable event. You can see the electron scattered and it's going in a different direction. And there's no way quantum physics and Heisenberg promises or guarantees, there's no way for you to measure and gain information about the message without disrupting it and disturbing it, or exchanging energy with it. In just the same way, there's no way that the electron or the photon necessarily scatters or disturbs or disrupts the electron by scattering off it. And so we can actually tell as we're setting up this secret code if anyone is eavesdropping on us. And we can always tell because Heisenberg's uncertainty principle guarantees that. And that's, it's a very, very hand-wavy way of looking at the details are more involved, and you actually probably see some quantum cryptography experiments and a lab at the Institute of Quantum Computing, but that's actually how you can tell and how quantum cryptography works. And I'll just say, that actually is a commercial reality now. They sell for about $50,000 US, so if you'd like to buy one, that's the website there. There's actually a quantum internet with about 5 or 6 nodes up and actually running at the moment in Boston. So this is a reality. This is by far the most advanced of the quantum technologies. And so banks are using it. Some banks, definitely military, US military is using it. And so this is a way of the future. So I think in 10, 15 years from now, you'll actually see this as being bigger. And Singapore, actually, we have someone from Singapore here, but Singapore, I believe, is setting up some sort of a quantum network in one of their cities, or may actually already be set up at the moment. But they're definitely doing some research in that.
How do I receive your message without disturbing it?
Oh, okay. So that will be something that they will go on about the Institute for Quantum Computing. So it's kind of a statistical thing, but that's, I might leave that for them, but it's not at all obvious, so that's a good question. So we might finish up there. So, and I'll just say more about these kind of deep, weird issues. Hans Westman's keynote presentation, Cats Collapses the Nature of Reality in Quantum Theory, on Friday. So what we might do now is we might come, maybe a little bit of shorter lunch, but come back at 5 to 1. So we want half an hour for the session. We've got tougher student questions. Where you'll be giving us the tougher student questions that you have, and Glenn Wagner will be answering every single one of those on the spot. So.